solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You're not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
It's really interesting. So what we see if we track people's expectations from their relationships, from marriage, is they've really shifted in the last 40, 50 years. And they're shifting across the globe, even though the way we partner with people is different in different countries. So if we think back to certainly our grandparents' generation, marriage was about bringing two families together. It was about financial stability. It was about rearing the next generation. And it was about companionship. You know, we didn't expect a middle-aged couple to have huge passion in their relationship. You know, that would almost be a little bit odd. And we certainly didn't expect our partner to be a partner for growth and development, right? It was someone who would hopefully provide a stable base with us, who would, you know, provide that comfort and companionship. That idea of marriage is really shifting. And what we see now is, first of all, people expect that passion to continue through the relationship. But they're also expecting their partners to be almost a sparring partner in their growth and development, to spur each other on, to bring out the best in each other. And it's really interesting if you look at the speeches of people when they thank their spouses. You know, in the past, it would be, you know, thank you for all your love and support and care. Oftentimes now people will say, you know, thank you for making me my best self.
Welcome to the 54th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm an executive coach and I help leaders play to their unique potential by helping them with the two questions, where to go and how to grow. These questions are quite parallel to the two questions businesses need to answer in the context of their strategy, where to play and how to win. In this podcast series, I talk to leaders from multiple domains, CEOs, sportsmen, artists, thought leaders, and so on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm excited about the lineup of guests coming up in the podcast. In the coming weeks, we have Matthew Walker, the author of Why We Sleep. We have Whitney Johnson, author of Disrupt Yourself. Whitney uses principles of Clay Christensen of Harvard Business School and his thinking around disruptive innovation and applies that to our journeys. A lot of my thinking and my choices have been influenced by his seminal book, How Will You Measure Your Life? You might be aware that he passed away recently on 23rd of Jan. He was a gentle giant indeed. We have Sir Andrew Lickyerman, former Dean of London Business School, who's been researching the topic of business judgment. I'm also likely to get time with Marshall Goldsmith, who's visiting India in April 2020. I'm excited about this prospect. As you would know, Marshall is a top-rated executive coach and is one of the legends in the field of coaching and leadership development. Let's now get to the conversation at hand. My guest today is Jennifer Petriglieri, Associate Professor of Organizational Behavior at INSEAD. She has recently authored the book Couples That Work, published in late 2019. In the book, she gets down into the details of how dual career couples can make it work. I feel it's a much needed piece of work and often the elephant in the room that nobody spoke about in a thoughtful and constructive manner. The backbone of her thesis is that she says couples need to navigate three big transitions in their journey. The first transition, she says, is when one of the spouses gets a promotion or when a child arrives. That transition is often around the question, how do we make it work? The second transition, she says, is when the couple approaches midlife and are grappling with more existential questions. The key question in this phase then, she says, is what do we want to become? The third transition, often towards the end of career when the firepower is diminished and possibly after the kids have left home, is often around the question, who are we and what's our purpose? I certainly learned a lot from the conversation, and I hope you will too. Without further ado, let's dive into my conversation with Jennifer Petriglieri. Jennifer, thank you so much for making the time to come on the Play to Potential podcast.
It's great to be here.
And would love to get into the book that you've just launched. But before that, I'm curious about people's journeys. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you developed interest in this field of work, starting from a background in genetics?
Yeah, so I think like many people at 18, I wasn't really sure what to do with my life, and science seemed a good sort of basic option. And while I enjoyed it, it wasn't really my thing. I was much more interested in people and the people side. So I went into business for 6-7 years, did my MBA, and my background is actually my parents are both academics. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, during the MBA year, just had this realization that I wanted to go back to the family business, I guess you could call it. So it was at that point that I took a big career transition and went back to school and studied for my PhD. And right from the get-go, I was interested in people's career transitions, their leadership transitions. And for the past 15 years, that's the area I've been working in. And then what I found in the last 5 or 10 years was that I was talking to people about their leadership journeys and their career transitions. And they would say to me, you know, if you really want to understand my career transitions, you should talk to my partner. And this piqued my interest because, you know, I'm a member of a working couple as well and know how intricately my husband and my career journeys are intertwined. And I started looking for research and found there really was very little research in this area. So there's a lot of work on work-life balance, you know, who manages the children, who does the household chores, but really almost nothing on the intersection of our careers. And so when we tend to talk about careers, and you will know this through all of your previous work and research, we tend to treat people as if they're flying solo, with no strings attached, right? We think about their career in isolation. And there hadn't been any work that had really looked at people's whole ecosystems and said, well, actually, for most people, that's not true. Our careers don't happen in isolation. They happen alongside those of our partners. And really, I went in with the question of how can we thrive with these two careers and make both careers work? And how did they interact? How do our transitions interact with each other? And how do our professional paths really shape each other's professional paths? So that was the spark for the research project, which eventually became the book.
Fascinating. Fascinating. And couldn't agree more that the context that we are in, whether it's, you know, whether it's your spouse or whether it's your children or parents, determines a lot of things as you're thinking about your career.
Absolutely.
And diving into the book, Jennifer, you talk about the fact that in your research, couples who report the highest level of satisfaction in their careers and relationships are most likely to have a double primary career model in which both partners' careers are considered important and neither is deemed secondary. I was curious about a couple of things here. One is, how do you think about primary and secondary? Just so that we are on the same page, I'd love for you to define those. And also, you know, I'm curious whether there's an economic consideration when we think about primary and secondary, or is there a different way to think about it?
Yeah. So when I think of primary, secondary, I really think both people still have careers, but the person in the primary position, their career would take some level of more importance or priority. So let's imagine there's a geographic move. The person with the primary career, their career would probably lead that geographic move. If there was a decision around, you know, who gets priority on work, travel, you know, hours invested in work, it would probably be the person in the primary position. Now, that's not to say that every single day their career always takes priority, but it's just on balance, their career will be the one prioritized and the person with the secondary career would invest a little bit more at home. Now, again, it doesn't mean that the primary person doesn't invest at all at home. It's just that the balance is tipped that way. And I think the finding around success is really interesting because, well, first of all, I think it's important we define success. True. You know, what do we mean by success? And the success I was interested in was people's subjective sense of success. Do I feel successful in my career? And do I feel successful in my relationship? And it is true that in my data, the couples who had two primary careers, that means they didn't place a weighting on one person's career over the other, were on average the most successful. Now,
just to be clear, there were plenty of people who had primary, secondary careers who also felt successful, and also people who took turns switching between primary, secondary. So it's not that that's the only model that can work. It's very important to point out. But the question that interested me as an academic was why? You know, why is this model more successful? Because when you think about it on the surface, it seems really hard, right? We're juggling these two careers of equal priority and juggling everything at home, you know, more or less equally. How do couples make that work? And what I found was it wasn't the model per se that was successful. It was what the model made couples do. And that model, because it was hard to juggle, it essentially forces couples to have very explicit conversations around priorities. It's as simple as that. Because it's hard to juggle, it makes us discuss, okay, how are we going to manage all these moving pieces? What are your priorities? What are my priorities? And how do we fit those together? Whereas the other models didn't necessarily have the forcing function to force couples into those conversations. And in fact, what made couples successful was not the model at all. It was the fact that they'd had those conversations and were very clear around their priorities, very clear around what's meaningful to us, what are we going to pursue, and what are the things we're going to drop. And I think this segues into your question around finances and money. Because, of course, very few of us are wealthy enough not to worry about money. You know, money is a concern for almost all of us. And, you know, whether that's money for today, whether that's building financial stability, whether that's building a nest egg for our children and on our extended families, you know, money is an important decision criteria. However, it can also be a red herring. And this is what I found in my research, was that couples who really made their decisions primarily based on the economics often ran into problems with their careers and relationally. And the reason is this: money is important, of course, but it's not the only thing. And very often, once we earn above a certain level, which is actually rather low, other things become important: opportunities for growth, making the transitions we're interested in, the location we live in, do we have enough time to be with our families, to balance our career? All of these things become factors. And when couples over-focused on the finances, they tended to, you know, unwittingly ignore those other things and make decisions that long-term they weren't very happy with. Now, that's not to say we should ignore the finances, but it should be one of many decision criteria. And I think the overweighting of it is what trips couples up.
And since you brought it up, maybe a quick question on whether there's a rule of thumb on how much is enough. You said there was a threshold. Is there a PPP adjusted heuristic to say,
you know? It's really interesting. So there's been all sorts of research on this. And in fact, there are whole streams of research they're called happiness researchers, which is always very interesting, who look at this. And the level is actually rather low. And so it obviously depends by country, but the level tends to be less than the median pay in the country you're in. So I'm not entirely sure what that is in India, but if I take France, where I am, you know, we're talking around 30,000, which is roughly the median. You know, once we're around that level, an increase in money doesn't increase our happiness.
Got it.
That, you know, it varies a little bit by country. And I'm always cautious about an exact figure because I think, you know, there's variance between people. But I think it just shows you that it's nowhere near as much as we think it might be.
And it's interesting you say median and not mean. I was just in a country like India, you know, given that there's just so much
variation,
standard deviation in sort of the economic outcomes. So
yeah,
I hear you.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's possibly a different conversation for a different day.
Yes. Yeah.
But coming back to the book, Jennifer, I liked one of the quotes that you bring up. You quote Eric Erickson and Daniel Levinson to say that it's the development crises that we face in our individual transitions that hold the potential for growth. Maybe just to frame the discussion ahead, tell us about the three transitions. You basically anchor the book around three big transitions that all couples need to navigate through the journey. So to talk to us about what these are, and then maybe we could dive into those.
Yeah. So I want to say a few words about how I discovered these transitions, because one of the things I found when I first started interviewing couples and looked at my data was that, you know, couples didn't struggle all the time, but neither was it a smooth ride all the time. And the struggles they face really came at three points in their career and life journey. And these points were actually rather predictable. And as you said, the book is organized around what I call the three transitions. And I can walk you through them very briefly, but they all revolve around essentially a developmental question that the couples are wrestling with. So the first transition revolves around the developmental question, how can we make this work? How can we structure our lives in a way that we can have two careers and a relationship and thrive in that arrangement? And it's a question that all couples face in the first period of their relationship together. And what's important to understand is that they face this whether we get together at 18, at 38, or at 68, we're all going through the first transition. And the reason this first transition here comes is if you think back a few moments to the first few months or years when you were in the relationship with your partner, you know, the honeymoon period, it was wonderful. and part of the reason it's wonderful, apart from its new love, is although you may feel very committed to each other, you're essentially living on parallel tracks, that you have the career path you had before you met, you had your friends and family, and you've layered on top this wonderful relationship. What's not to like? But that never lasts, because eventually couples will hit a life event or a tough choice that means they need to combine those parallel tracks into one life, right? How do we really make this work all together? And that tends to be, could be a number of things. It could be, you know, maybe you get offered, I know you've moved a lot in your career. You know, you decide to do your MBA in London Business School. You know, what do you do? Does your partner follow you? Do you live apart? Do you go separate ways? It's very clear at that point you can't live on parallel tracks. Sure. It might be for some people who've had a very stable life together. It might be the arrival of your first child. For any parents out there, we know that that's the end of parallel living. Right? We need to make some hard choices and figure out how these pieces are going to fit together. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, for couples who meet in later life, it might be a question of, you know, how do we blend families from previous relationships? You know, how do we figure all these things out? And this first transition point is a very tricky one. And it looks on the surface very practical, you know, location, childcare, logistics, finances, and all those things are important. But it's often a much more psychological question of, you know, who leads and who follows in the relationship, who holds the power, you know, what do we really want? How do we figure out the things we want? All these questions come up in this first transition, and I'm sure we can get into the detail a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But that's the first transition, and that's linked to our couple stage. The second transition is really interesting because it's linked to our career stage. It's linked to the stage that we typically think of as mid-career, which roughly occurs around our mid-40s, but it's not necessarily linked to age. It's really linked to career stage. And if we think back to our 20s and 30s and what's happening in our career at that stage, it's a period of striving. We're building our careers, we're building our expertise, we're building our knowledge, we're building our standing in the profession we've chosen. And we're striving, 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 running, running, running. And it's a, and the path we take in those first two decades is always a mix of what we really want and social expectations. So, you know, maybe your parents were engineers, so they strongly recommended you went to engineering school, or they were doctors and they recommended you followed that path. Maybe when we graduated, like you did from an MBA program, you know, the cool thing to do at that time was to go into a big consultancy firm. And so everyone flocks in that direction. And these social expectations, they're not bad things. They often come from people who love us and they want us to succeed. But what happens when we reach our mid-career point is that many of us reach a point where we start thinking, you know, maybe that path I'm on, it just doesn't quite feel my own. And of course, it doesn't quite feel our own because we've partly chosen it in response to these social expectations. And when people start having those thoughts, as you will well know from the people you work with in your work on career transitions,
And my own journey as well.
Yeah, it brings up a lot of existential questions, if not just about, is this the right organization? Is this the right life structure? Do I have the right balance between my family and work? You know, what do I really want from life? These are big existential questions. And this second transition can be a particularly tough one for couples, because if there's two of you wrestling with these big existential questions at the same time, it can be very, very destabilizing for couples.
And also, maybe if I might jump in, it's also a time where you have very limited mind space, because when I look around, careers are peaking, careers are demanding, and plus the children are growing and are quite demanding. And sometimes in some situations, the parents are aging. So in a way, if you look at residual mind space to have a thoughtful conversation with your spouse or with yourself, it's extremely squeezed. So I wonder if you've had any observations there.
Absolutely. It's extremely squeezed. And the other thing is at this point in time, we have a lot of responsibilities. As you said, we may have children that we're bringing into this world and their children who are probably still dependent on us at this time. For the first time in our lives, our parents are becoming dependent on us. And often at work, our careers are peaking. So there's lots of employees or people we mentor who are dependent on us. And what this can do is it can make us think, I should be responsible and ignore these questions. So I've neither got the time nor the luxury to indulge in these more existential questions. And of course, but we know in our own skin what happens when we try and do that. You know, we'll bottle these questions for a while, but they'll just get bigger and bigger. And if we're not careful, they explode into, you know, what can be quite a significant existential crisis. And so it's a very difficult time because we're time poor, we're responsibility heavy, and it's a tough time to transform. However, this second transition holds the power for enormous growth, both professionally and also in our relationship with our partners and our children and our parents, if, you know, if we still have that combination. And so it's the transition that I found could have the potential to be the most transformative. And again, I'm sure we'll dig into the details later. Sure. But I think it's really important for anyone listening who's at that stage now to take it seriously and really respect those questions, as opposed to saying, okay, I need to brush them under the carpet because too busy, not got enough time, too many responsibilities. Yeah.
Sure.
So that's the second transition. And the third transition is actually a really interesting one. So it comes at a later stage when our social roles are changing. So our children, if we've had them, are leaving home. We're no longer the bright young things, the high potential people in our organizations. We've really gone into the more senior role. Hopefully we're managing those people. We're the mentors of the organization. And this time represents a real time of opposites. So on the one hand, we can feel a sense of loss. Right? I'm no longer that hands-on parent. I'm no longer that bright young thing, that high potential person in the organization. At the same time, it can represent huge opportunity. So for the first time in a number of decades, we have freedom. That may be financial freedom. It might be more time freedom. And because our careers are shifting, we know that our careers are lengthening. So if we think back to maybe our parents' or our grandparents' generation, certainly when this third transition came around, it was at a time when we were really on the off ramp down to retirement. We had 4 or 5 years left. We were going to get the gold watch and retire and look after the growing grandchildren. That's not the case anymore. First of all, our careers are longer. So this may come at a time when we've still got 10, 15, potentially even 20 years left in our careers. And because people are having children later right across the world, it's a period where our children have left home, but we're probably not going to be expecting grandchildren for a little while. So we sort of have this freedom from parenting type duties that, again, would not have been present in the past. What's also happening, as you well know, is there's a real change in careers. So we have the rise of the gig economy, portfolio careers. It's easier to go into entrepreneurship than ever. And what we're seeing in this third transition are people are making really interesting career moves that are what I think of as about broadening horizons. So if we think of the stage where you and I are right now, if we can get through a day and we've managed to keep in mind our career, our relationship and our kids, we've done pretty well.
tremendously reassuring.
Then we fall into bed exhausted, wake up the next morning and repeat. You know, and I was out for dinner with my best friend a few months ago, and she's the CFO of an organization. And we were saying, you know, one day we will, you know, take on some boards of not-for-profits, or one day we will do some volunteering work, these things. But at our stage of life, the reality is it's not happening for most of us. But suddenly at this third transition is a time when we have the freedom so we can broaden our horizons out from this focus on family, relationship, career to volunteering, to legacy, to portfolio careers, to entrepreneurship, to not-for-profits. And so we see for the first time in our career journey these opportunities to go wide as opposed to go narrow. And it's very interesting because ours is, you know, the generation who's at this point now are the first generation in history who've been able to en masse do this broadening. You know, before it was, you know, we're on the ramp down to retirement. And so it's a period of real invention. And the generation who are there at the moment are really the vanguard generation, because none of us have been able to do this before. So they're blazing the trail for the rest of us when we get there.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. Of the three transitions that Jennifer speaks about, my wife and I are going through the second transition. And like any other couple, we have our good days and bad days. While each individual in each couple's context is unique and different, the one pattern I often observe is that when men and women in their midlife approach it from a "I want to have it all" mindset at an individual level, I notice that it often has disastrous implications on the couple and the wider family context. No silver bullets here, but as Jennifer says, the best bet is to have honest conversation with ourselves and our partner around the choices, trade-offs, and the implications across the various domains of life. To use Professor Stuart Friedman's language, who was earlier in the podcast, you want to be solving across four domains: self, work, home, and community. If this is of interest, please visit the guest section at playtopotential.com and look for Stuart Friedman. In the conversation, he speaks about how we can craft some small experiments to bring greater harmony across the various domains of life. If you're deriving value from the podcast, do consider paying it forward to Antarang Foundation, a not-for-profit that I support, that helps kids from challenging backgrounds play to their potential. To know more, please visit the Pay It Forward section at playtopotential.com. If you're deriving value from the podcast, do also take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to consume the podcast. It will help others discover the content. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Jennifer Petriglieri. Mm-hmm. And do you notice in your research any significant differences in the way these transitions play out across cultures or contexts?
It's a great question. And one of the things that surprised me most in my research was there was actually a lot less cultural variation than you would think. The main piece of cultural variation comes around children and families. And if you think about it, this makes sense because this is how culture is passed on, right, through our children. And so in certain, let's take China as an example. With the one-child policy, there are four grandparents vying to look after one child. You know, childcare, all these kind of things are just a lot easier. It's very normal for both parents to work and the grandparents to take on that responsibility. We know in countries like India, in southern European countries where my husband is from, there's a lot more mixing across the generation and a lot more sense that raising a family is an extended family's job as opposed to a nuclear family's job. Whereas if I think about England, where I'm from, or the US, we tend to think of raising a family as the job of the nuclear family. And so these really impact the dynamics around the family work interface. But in terms of the transitions themselves and the actual psychological dynamics, what's happening here, very, very little difference. It's really about the social context in which these are unfolding in, if that makes sense.
So Jennifer, let's talk about the first transition. When do we know we're in that transition? You started talking about it, but I'm curious about what are the triggers to look out for when the first transition happens?
Yeah. So the triggers of the first transition are really the first tough choices we need to make as a couple. And we know when we're there, when for the first time in our relationship, we start to feel a bit anxious. So usually in that honeymoon period, everything's plain sailing and we sometimes can, and I know I did this as well, we naively look at other couples and think, oh, they're struggling, but we're so great. That's never going to happen to us. And this usually comes at the first point where we struggle as a couple. And that struggle is around, you know, how do we fit all of this together and make sure that both of us gets most of what we're aiming for. Now, of course, it's impossible that we both get everything we're aiming for, but that most of both of us feel we have a shot at some of those things that are important to us.
Got it. And you also talk about the notion of couple contracting.
Yeah.
It sounds quite formal and legal, but you make the case for having that kind of a conversation between spouses. I think as I reflect on my journey and some of the conversations I have with my friends and the leaders I work with, the challenge sometimes is creating that space for such a conversation. What's been your observation around how some people get around to doing this well?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the thing which holds people back is, you know, I don't have time or this is going to take forever. And the way I think about it is not just one conversation. It's really about developing the habit of talking about these things. And what do I mean by these things? And as you said, although I call it contracting, I don't mean something you write in blood and sign your life away on. It's really about developing the habit of talking about three things. The first is what really matters to us. Now, this might be specific career goals we have. It might be a couple goal around financial stability, around living in a certain location. It might be a goal we have around carving time out for pursuits that we're really interested in. It's very important we understand what we're aiming for individually and as a couple and what our partners are aiming for. And the reason is right now, there are a lot, most people have a lot of opportunities and a lot of options. And the thing which tends to trip couples up most is they try to do too much. And oftentimes when they step back, some of the things they're doing are actually not that important to them. They're doing them because they feel they should or because everyone else is doing them. And so being very clear around what are our goals and what matters to us just makes that decision making a lot easier. If something,
is there an example or a story you could share?
Yeah,
when you say too much?
Yeah. So let's imagine the first transition comes at a time when you have children, which is when the potential for all the different things we could do, you know, often expands. How much time do we invest in career, etc.? Now, one of the conversations it's really important to have is what kind of family do we want to be? What matters most to us? Are we the family that wants to be really embedded in our nuclear families so that the cousins all grow up together? Are we the kind of family that wants to be an adventure family where we go on trips and really show different parts of the world to the kids? These are very different types of families, and they would make us choose to do different things because we all have finite time. And what can happen in those early years is that we can think, oh, we're just going to do a bit of everything. And then, of course, everyone becomes frazzled. It negatively impacts on our careers. It negatively impacts on, you know, the emotional welfare of us and the children. But if we've been very clear around what is the kind of family we want to build, and therefore, what are the choices around holidays and weekends, and do they stack up with that vision we have for who we want to become as a family? You can think of that in terms of your career as well. What career goals do you both have? Is it about growth in terms of knowledge? Is it about rising up the hierarchy? Is it about having a career with a lot of geographical moves and seeing different pieces of the country? If we're very clear about that, when we're given career opportunities from our employers or if we're poached by, as you said, a poaching company like he used to work for, It becomes a lot easier to make those decisions mindfully rather than get attracted by a big salary rise or a prestigious title or something that looks high status, we can come back to the ground and say, okay, this opportunity looks wonderful. Does it align with what we want?
And it gives you criteria to evaluate opportunities.
And it's really important to have that up front and to have an ongoing conversation around that, because the number of times I would speak to people and they would say, you know, I woke up and I just felt like, how did I get here? And it's not that anything was bad per se, but this is not where I want to be in life. You know, this is, you know, I had all these different options and I've just sort of swum along with the tide and it's taken me somewhere that is not objectively bad, but it's just not what I want. So many people end up in that situation. And it's just because they've been drifting without really sitting down with their partners and thinking about, okay, what is it we want? Does this align? Yes, no. Do we take it? Yes, no.
Mm-hmm. So, and back to the conversations, I think you said three.
Yeah, so that's the first piece. The second piece is really related. It's what are the lines we're not going to cross? Now, this conversation is a little bit counterintuitive because in most of our countries, we think about choice being a good thing. The more choice we have, the better. But the research actually shows the exact opposite. The more choice we have, the harder it is to choose and the more likely we are to regret our choices. And so what helps couples is by saying, okay, if these are some lines we're not going to cross, and they might be geographical lines, what is a country or an area of the country we just wouldn't go to? It might be a timeline around how much work is too much work that's going to negatively impact us. It might be around travel. How much work travel do you have to do that is just really bad for the family and unacceptable? When we have those lines as a couple, what it does is, firstly, it makes decision-making a lot easier because if something's outside the lines, it's a no. But it also, if you like, defines the field we're going to play on. And it's like, this is the field we want to play on. And if an opportunity comes up that's within this field, then we talk about it and we consider and we think. But if an opportunity comes up in another field where we've said, for whatever reason that is for us, that's out of bounds, it's a lot easier to pass on. So maybe I can give you an example to demonstrate this. And I'm going to give you an example of a couple earlier stage of life. And they were actually one of my MBA students. And as you know, on an MBA program, there are good recruitment years and there are bad recruitment years. You know, there are some years where the job market's buoyant, there's lots of opportunities, and others where it's not so great. And this was one of those years where there were a lot of options around. And one of my students came to me and he looked really upset. And I said to him, what's wrong? And he said, I've just been offered the job of my dreams. And I said, you do not look like you've been offered the job of your dreams. You tell me more. And he said, you know, well, it was to open the office of a very prominent NGO in an African country. And I said, so why the long face? And he said, well, you know, I went home to discuss it with my wife and she said, we just cannot move there. And I said, okay, why did you apply for the job then? And he said, oh, well, we thought that because there were so many options, I said, just apply to everything that looked good, wait until the offers come in, and then we'd make the decision. But of course, we know very well in the job process that very few people are really enthusiastic about a job until they've gone through the recruitment process and got the offer. And at which point, not being able to take it is a huge disappointment. Whereas if up front they'd drawn those geographic boundaries and said, you know, for us, Africa is outside of those boundaries, he would never have applied to the job, no disappointment. And this happens time and time again in couples. You know, one will get a great opportunity, or in some cases, even take the opportunity. And then we see those negative consequences down the line.
This situation is also a search consultant's nightmare, right?
Absolutely.
somebody says yes to the job and 1 week later says, no, actually, you know what? My wife can't move this, so yeah. I'm not going to take this up.
And as you know, this happens all the time. And of course, this creates huge conflict in couples. And the third area, and so again, this is really important to talk about and to revisit, because of course, the things we want and the boundaries in our late 20s are different in our late 40s. You know, this isn't something that sticks over time. And the final area to have an ongoing conversation about, and the area that I find is a little bit more difficult for couples, is what are some of the things that worry us? What are some of the things that scare us about the future? Whether it's about our careers, our relationship, the geography we live. And the reason these are very important is twofold. One is that very often we worry about things that are non-issues for our partners. So let me give you an example of a later couple. I was talking to a couple and they were having a lot of conflict around sort of what to do in the latter piece of their career. Their children had left home and they just really couldn't figure it out. And I always speak to couples separately. And I spoke to him and he said, look, the issue is I know she wants to move to where the grandchildren are. And I mean, I just don't want to do that, right? I want to have some time of freedom and I want to pursue our careers in the last thing. So he said, but I just can't talk about it with her because I know that's what she wants. I talked to her. It's not what she wants at all. It's not even on her mind. But this fear of his was creating this big issue, which was not actually a real issue. And this happens time and time again. We imagine something is going to happen, which is not even on the cards. So that's one reason it's important to talk about the things we're worried about. The second reason is, of course, some of those things may be potentials. And a good example here is for any of your listeners who are married to people whose family has a different culture from theirs. And I don't necessarily mean national culture, but just is a very different feel. And very often this can, those of us who are in those situations, this can cause conflicts. You know, what do we do around the holidays? You know, one family has very different traditions from the other. And it's real, right? This is a real fear. But when we discuss these things as a couple, it's much easier for us to sensitively manage them. You know, if I know that you're worried about my parents taking over all the holiday festivities, it's much easier for me to really sensitively manage that boundary than if I think you're okay with it, in which case I won't do anything and it will become a big issue. So having those conversations, which can feel a little bit more difficult, actually long-term help couples to avoid some of the situations that can be very conflictual, both for our relationship, but also vis-a-vis our careers and locations and these kind of questions.
I was just smiling as you made the last point because my father was a public sector banker.
Yeah.
And my father-in-law was a brigadier in the Indian Army.
Uh-huh.
So talking about cultural differences, I was just sort of smiling to myself about.
I can only imagine.
But back to the first transition, Jennifer, you speak about a few decoys in this context, mm-hmm. right, that some couples fall into. One, you say, is relying on economic decision criteria. We briefly spoke
yes.
about it. You also talk about a couple of other things, focusing on the short term, concentrating on the practical and striving to do it all.
Yeah.
Give us a sense of the key insight here.
Yeah. So we know that we all of us humans have a short term decision bias. So we tend to evaluate options based on, are they good for me now versus are they good for me in a year, 2 years, 5 years time? And particularly in our first transition, when we naturally have a bit less life experience, couples tend to look at decisions based on, are they good for us now? So let me give you a classic example. And we were talking a little bit before we turned the podcast on about maternity leave, you know. Uh-huh. So one of the options we can think of is, you know, what is good for us as a family right now in terms of childcare, in terms of maternity leave, in terms of length of maternity leave and things like this, without considering the consequences of those choices in not even in the long term, but in the medium term. So we know, for example, most women do want a maternity leave, of course, to spend time with their precious new babies. And most men also want a paternity leave as well. But we mm-hmm. also know that once we take extended paternity or maternity leaves, that has real serious career consequences. Now, some people are very happy to pay the price of those consequences, and that's great. That's their choice. But many people are just not really thinking through what those consequences might be. So take decisions that look like they work now, but then long term have these impacts, not just on their salary trajectory, but can I get to the next level in the organization? And so what looks like it works now, even in 2-3 years time, suddenly becomes a major regret. So that's the idea of short-term decision-making. The idea of focusing on the practicalities is a little bit related to the financial decision, but it's also about logistics, you know, childcare, housecare, all these sort of things. When couples get too much into these practicalities, financial or otherwise, they forget to talk about what's really underneath, right? Why are we in it together? What do we want out of life? How are we going to support each other? And so many couples I spoke to would say to me, you know, we've synced our calendars and we have this Excel spreadsheet that shows how we're going to divide up all the tasks, and it's still not working. And it's not working because those practical things at the end of the day, they're not the issue. The issue is
efficient but not effective.
Exactly.
Right, one of those things.
If you as a couple can figure out what you really want and how you can support each other to get there, the practicalities will sort themselves out. You know, every couple struggles with practicalities at one point in time, but the practicalities are not the root of the problem. And this is a classic trap in the first transition, because it's the first time when we really struggle with something, right? Things aren't working. And most of us are quite problem-solving people, and we immediately go to those practicalities, but they're not the root of the issue. And the final thing, doing it all, is if we think back to those early days of our relationship when maybe we've not got children who are dependent on us, our parents aren't dependent on us, we're really free agents. In those days, we can have it all. You know, there's all this debate, can you have it all? But the reality is, in our early careers, we probably can, right? We can have our career, we can travel, we can have a nice relationship. You know, we have enough money just about to do what we want to do. But that doesn't last forever. You know, once the responsibilities pile up, we cannot have it all. But that imprinting, if you like, from early in our lives makes us think we should be able to have it all forever. And therefore, we just try and do it all. And this just leads to burnout. And this is a classic thing that happens after the first child, right? We want to just add the child on top of everything else we've done. So not only do we want this great career and great relationships and circles of friends, and we want to travel at weekends, but now we also want to be perfect parents and our children to be great as well. Well, those things don't all sit well together. But by trying to keep all these balls in the air and doing it all, of course, we burn out, and lots of conflicts come in our relationships, and our careers suffer as well.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I like what Jennifer says here. She says that we often want to have it all and add having a child on top of everything else we have going on in our lives. Something very similar came up in my conversation with Matt Dixon, a triathlon coach in Silicon Valley. He works with several time-starved executives. And in my conversation, one of the questions I asked him was, how do these busy leaders layer on exercise on top of everything else they have going on in their lives? And this is what he said.
You're taking something like training or sport or whatever it might be, and you're dumping it on top of life. So, and that will always yield failure. It would always yield underperformance, the accumulation of stress and fatigue. And so the biggest mistake that we see people make is to think, I know I need to exercise because I know that's something to do that makes me really healthy. So how am I going to just add this on top of life? And many people, what they do, and a great example is, oh, it's wonderful, I've got a bunch of friends, I'm going to do Ironman Turkey, and it sounds wonderful. And they, what does it take to train for that? And it takes 20 hours a week. Goodness me, I don't have 20 hours a week, but there's the training program, and that's what I need to do. I'm going to dump it on top of life, and I'm just going to have to find a way to cram it in. To be successful, and to actually integrate the key components of rejuvenation and recovery, as well as training, what we have to realize is that we have to integrate it into a person's life so that not only can they improve in that discipline, because hopefully they're looking for improvement, but so that it can lift their health, it can lift their performance as a CEO or an executive, and it can help them thrive across all areas of life.
If you want to know more about integrating different domains of life, you might like my conversation with Professor Stuart Friedman of Wharton. he speaks about how we could think about integrating across four domains: self, work, home, and community. The metaphor that comes to mind in this context is like solving a three-piece jigsaw and then having an extra piece. Now, if you have a four-piece jigsaw, then you need to solve the puzzle afresh to get to a meaningful place. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Jennifer Petriglieri. Let's transition to the second transition, if I may.
Yeah.
Talk to us about how it shows up in our lives.
Yeah, so the second transition, very different. And it usually starts with that sense of just niggling doubts, like, maybe I'm just not very happy with the organization, or is the grass greener on the other side? Or, you know, I always thought of doing this career, maybe I should look at it. And those questions often start fairly small. You know, we're, you know, maybe I should go on a training course to decide something out, you know, to figure out a different way of looking at this. But they quite quickly develop into bigger questions of, is this the life I want? What do I really want out of life? What's the best path for me? Where do my passions lie? And it can feel very disturbing emotionally. You know, we can feel really unsure of ourselves, even if we're very confident people naturally. We can suddenly feel like the ground beneath us is starting to fall away. And this sense that, oh, I'm not even sure who I am anymore. And this can spiral really quickly into these very big existential questions. And it's very normal in couples that once one person starts thinking about these things, the other person will as well. So we're both in this quite precarious emotional state, if I can put it that way.
Hmm. And you use the term reciprocal individuation in this context. I found that phrase interesting. Talk to us about what you mean by this.
Yeah. So the task at this period of life is what we think of as individuation. Now, what that means is figuring out what is the path that is genuinely my path. So as we talked about before, the path we often take in our 20s and 30s is a bit of a mix of what we really want and the social expectations. And this transition point is a point where we can, for the first time, really figure out, okay, what is really my path? What's the individual path that's suited for me? And what I found in couples is there's a reciprocity in that, that if I go on a journey and you support me to find my individual path, that helps you in your journey. And this is where the, if you like, the couple can become a self-reinforcing system, that if one person's on this journey, the other person can go there as well.
And you also talk about a zero-sum approach versus a positive-sum approach in discovering what's possible. Talk to us about maybe linking it back to how two people in a relationship can figure out their respective paths. Talk to us about what you mean by this here.
Yeah, so very often, and very often actually when we talk about relationships, we talk about them through the idea of a zero-sum game. So, you know, there's a pie and the more I get, the less you get. So, you know, if I push ahead in my career, that means you can't push ahead in yours. So when we have a zero-sum view of our relationship, this is when we get to the language of trade-offs and sacrifices. You know, I gave this up for you, now it's your turn to give something up for me. But what I found is that it doesn't necessarily have to be that way in couples. One person's growth and development can bleed over and spark the other person's growth and development, such that there becomes a sense in the couple that the more you succeed and grow, the more that enables me to succeed and grow, which is a very different mindset from thinking about it as the more you succeed and grow, the more that diminishes me, the less opportunity I have to do this. And what I found that was really interesting is this was a mindset. It wasn't based on any objective fact. So we can think our way into this growth mindset, this positive sum mindset, as opposed to the you know, the zero sum mindset, whereas if you gain, I lose.
And as I think about this, I guess when two people are trying to figure out, you know, their respective pathways, I'm guessing one of them there's going to be a timing issue, just like the first transition. One of them is going to land somewhere maybe a little earlier than the other. So clearly there's a need for the other person, even if they are, you know, still sort of figuring the way through their own pathway, to sort of have that mindset to make it work and move. Is that a fair way of understanding this?
Yes, absolutely. And this is where, first of all, it becomes really important that couples are talking as they're going through this transition and not just presenting a fait accompli at the end to say, okay, this is what I've decided, this is what we're going to do. Because our thinking influences each other. And even if you reach your conclusion before me, if we've been thinking and talking about it together along the way, then we're more likely to shape each other's solutions, if that makes sense. But yes, of course, it's very natural that one person may come to a decision and a transition point before the other. And what's really important there is, again, we don't just think short term, which is this works for you, let's go for it. We've got to expand that to a more long-term thinking and think, okay, this works for you, that's great. Is there any way that this could shutter off future options for me? And if so, what is it? So at least we go into it mindfully. And so it's really that long-term thinking that's going to help us in that situation and the ongoing conversation so we can develop our ideas together. And if couples do that, the synchronicity issue is not so much of a problem.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Given my stage of life and the nature of the clientele I work with, this is possibly the segment I have the most visibility to. The biggest disconnect I find is that leaders who are having a successful career often don't have the residual mind space to engage in this discussion mindfully for themselves, leave alone for their spouse. Tying this to Bob Keegan's work on adult development, I think this is a phase where a lot of us are moving from the phase of having a socialized mind to a self-authoring mind. We're trying to move away from the expectations that people have of us to moving on to what we really want to do. But the conundrum here is that for us to sit with it, as Jennifer says, and for the answer to emerge, there's a certain stillness required. And if you're on a treadmill, then it is structurally impossible for you to create that space and stillness. And that's why Bob Keegan's research shows that around 50 to 60% of elderly adults are stuck in this phase of having a socialized mind, never making the transition to a self-authoring version of themselves. And I think that's a tragedy and has significant residual ramifications on stress levels, health, quality of relationships with the family, and so on and so forth. This is also a phase where I feel people should gather where to go feedback. In the advisory work I do, when I'm working with a leader at Crossroads, I end up speaking to his or her colleagues, relatives, and some members in the ecosystem. For example, members of the YPO forum, if the person is a young leader, and so on. Apart from gathering insights around strengths and development areas, in this phase, one is trying to get a sense of what gives the person energy and what makes him or her come alive. The question at this stage is, what is the ideal canvas for this person, given all of his or her experiences, skills, passions, and given the context and what the person is trying to solve for? And the response to this question is often very different from the response to the question, how does a person get better in his or her role, which is often a how-to-grow discussion. In this phase, developing outsight can be as critical as developing insight by sitting with it, as Jennifer says. If this topic is of interest, you might like my conversation with Tasha Urick, who speaks about how we can leverage insight and outsight to enhance our self-awareness. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Jennifer Petriglieri. And you also talk about the distinction between doing and being here.
Yeah.
I was curious about that distinction. Talk to us about the crux of the insight here.
And I'm sure you find this in your transitions. Many of us, especially in today's world, we're programmed to just do things all the time. If there's an issue, we think, okay, what can I do about it? Which in some aspects of life is great. But when it comes to these transitions where we're fundamentally thinking about, you know, who am I? Who do I want to become? It's important that we get out of this action mode and into this more reflective mode and into this mode of being and really sitting with those questions. Because when we're talking about these more existential questions in transitions, they are not questions we can solve by sitting down with an Excel spreadsheet, you know, in an hour and thinking it through. They're questions that need time to mature. They need time to reflect on. We need to have multiple conversations about them to really reach an answer. And the way I sometimes think of this is a little bit about when we're pregnant, right? It's not good to give birth too early. The baby needs a certain amount of time, you know, 9 months to develop before it's ready. And I think transitions are often like this. People who jump too early, who try to give birth, if you like, to their transition too early, often are ones who end up making moves that they regret. That it takes a certain amount of time to really figure out really well, what is the path I really want and how am I going to get there? And it's very important we sit with that and give it the time it deserves.
That's a great point. I mean, one of the guests, ex-faculty at INSEAD, Herminia Ibarra,
Yeah. She
spoke about this notion of foreclosure,
Yeah. Where
she said when she looked at transitions, one of the most common traps people fell into was just closing too early on an option.
Yes.
And to your point, there's something to be said about cooking things for a while before we take the plunge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe just picking up on that, Herminia also talks about this notion of liminality,
Yeah. Where
your identity is in suspension. I was curious about how this plays out in the context of a couple, when a couple is navigating this together.
Yeah.
And maybe just to link it to another thing you say in the book, you also talk about mutual secure-based relationships.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're connected.
Yes. So when we think of these big transitions, the thing which really helps couples is to shift their model of support. So when we think of what is a supportive relationship in couples, we very often think of good old British tea and sympathy. So I'm going to plump up your self-esteem, try and make you feel good about yourself. If you have a setback, I will, you know, tell you you're the best thing in the world, which is, you know, who doesn't like this? It's lovely. But essentially what that kind of support does is it keeps us in our comfort zone, which feels great, but it's not helpful for a big transition. Because we all know that to make a transition, we've got to get out there and take risks. We've got to explore different options. We've got to experiment with potential paths. It's a bit of a contact sport, if I can put it that way.
Sure.
And if we're stuck in our couples with this very close model of support, it can keep people in their comfort zone and really inhibit that exploration and experimentation. So the couples who do very well, I found, are those who flick their model of support from that to a model of support called a secure base. Now, a secure base means three things. First, it means, of course, there is that level of comfort, that level of support, but layered on top of that are another two things. One is a loving kick away from the relationship. So a loving push away to say, you know, I'll be here to dust you off, but you get out there and figure it out. So if you're unsure, if you're having these existential questions, the response is, don't worry, we'll be fine. It's okay, get out there then and figure something out. So it's this push to explore, a push away from the safety of the relationship, away from the comfort zone and into that learning zone, that risk zone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a bit counterintuitive because in a relationship, when our partner's feeling a little bit uncertain and a little bit wobbly, our natural instinct, just like that with our children, is to hold them close, is to give them a cuddle, you know, metaphorically and really. And this is quite the opposite. When we see our partner struggling with something, feeling a little unsure, instead of pulling them close, we actually push them away in a loving way. And so it's quite a different model of support. But the third thing about a secure base is it's also a very arm's length support. So it's not about interfering. It's not about, did you call that headhunter and did you read that book and did you go to that networking event? That's really unhelpful. So it's a real arm's length push away. And what I found in couples was when they could both do this for each other, when they could both provide the secure base, that's when the magic happened. Because what happened was both partners could then go out and do the work of experimentation, exploration, and reflection that all of us need to do to get through a transition. And both felt very supported in that, and both could get to the other side. And I think, you know, when we first started talking about the second transition, I said this could be a time of incredible growth for people in their careers and relationship. And this growth really stems from this secure-based support at the root of our relationships.
You also say that this phase is the peak time for breakups and divorce, and you allude to the notion of relational resilience. Talk to us about what's at play here.
Yeah, so it is. It's a very dicey period. It can either go great or it can go badly.
High beta, as they say in finance.
High beta. Why is the question? It's because when we see our partners wrestling with these questions, it's very easy for us to interpret that as an issue with our relationship. You know, if you're not happy, is that my fault? Am I doing something wrong? You know, if you're questioning your direction, are you also questioning your relationship? And what can happen in couples who are not talking and not providing the secure base to each other is they can get into a spiral of doubting each other, of secrecy, of resentment. And we all know that's the fast-tracked divorce. And when we look at the divorce statistics, we do see there's a peak around this kind of phase of our careers and our lives. And so it really can go one way or the other. And that's why this ongoing dialogue and this secure-based support is so vital at this time. And also this idea of relational resilience. You know, even if you are really supporting each other in the right way and you're going out there and exploring and experimenting, it is tough. For all of us who've been through a big transition know it's tough psychologically. It's tough because there's a degree of uncertainty. You know, it's tough because it's emotionally tough, and that can put strain on couples. And so couples really need to be resilient. But we know that couples grow a lot closer to each other when they go through these tough periods. Hmm. So it may feel really hard in the moment, but we do know that couples that come out the other side of this often emerge a lot stronger than when they went in.
Right. Let's now maybe turn the attention to the third transition, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about the primary question, who are we now, that couples go through.
Yes.
Here. I'm curious about how the exploration of this question is different from the exploration for what do we want out of life, which we encounter in transition two.
Yeah, so transition two, I think of as really about direction, right? What's the path I've been on? That needs to change. You know, do I need to turn left, right, double back on myself? It's really a question of direction. When we get to the third transition, it's much more a question of purpose. You know, I've had a chunk of my career. Kids have left home. You know, who am I now, right? What's my purpose in life? What am I trying to achieve? And the big difference at this stage is that kind of deeper level of identity that's through the questioning and the potential of what we can do with it. So as I said when I introduced this transition, this is a time where really for the first time in most of our lives, we can very significantly broaden our horizons. So who I am is not just about my professional role, you know, the fact that I'm a mother and a wife and a daughter. Suddenly, who I am can be a multitude of things because I have this more time and freedom. And so while on the surface we still may be going through a career transition, it's very qualitatively different from that career transition in the second transition. And it's really quite different questions, we're wrestling with in that third stage because of this potential to broaden up. And also because we have lost some roles that we formerly had. We're not the bright young thing. We're no longer the hands-on parents. So there's a real question of, poof, you know, who am I if I'm not those things? So it's really about that level of identity.
And to get a sense of the trend across generations, for a minute, if we look at Malala Yousafzai or Greta Thunberg,
yeah,
or the millennials, one gets to hear that, you know, the word purpose is entering these people's lives much, much earlier.
Yeah.
Now, in your research, do you see a difference across generations, in terms of how transition two and three is playing out? Or is it still, does it still hold even with the youngsters of today?
Well, obviously they're not at that stage yet. So it's still an empirical question.
As they grow, yeah.
Yeah, it's still an empirical question. But I think more is made of the difference between generations than there actually is. And if you talk to real demographers, they will say the way we talk about our choices may differ, but the choices we make and the things which concern us are actually fairly similar if we think about our generation at that age or the generation at transition three at that age. I think it's much more socially acceptable to talk about purpose, but we're still thinking about what's the purpose in my career, for example. So I think if you talk to the demographers, there are shifts in the way we narrate these things, but it's an empirical question as to whether that will change when they get to our phase or the third transition phase. And it'll be very interesting to see.
That's a good point. And maybe it's also the social media which amplifies some of these people. And maybe one could make the case that these people always existed across various generations.
I think so. And I think we have to be careful not to extrapolate from a small number of high profile examples.
Of course.
I think, you know, Malala and Greta are incredibly inspiring people. And it would be lovely if we were all like that. But I'm not sure everybody is.
Yep. And coming back to Maslow's hierarchy, you talk about it in the context of transition three. And I like one of the things you say. You say that self-actualization is a bit like icing on the cake if we look at Maslow's hierarchy. But you actually mentioned that couples don't see it as an icing, but view it as one of the ingredients. Say more here.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So what we see if we track people's expectations from their relationships, from marriage, is they've really shifted in the last 40, 50 years. And they're shifting across the globe, even though the way we partner with people is different in different countries. So if we think back to certainly our grandparents' generation, marriage was about bringing two families together. It was about financial stability. It was about rearing the next generation. And it was about companionship. You know, we didn't expect a middle-aged couple to have huge passion in their relationship. You know, that would almost be a little bit odd. And we certainly didn't expect our partner to be a partner for growth and development, right? It was someone who would hopefully provide a stable base with us, who would, you know, provide that comfort and companionship. That idea of marriage is really shifting. And what we see now is, first of all, people expect that passion to continue through the relationship. But they're also expecting their partners to be almost a sparring partner in their growth and development, to spur each other on, to bring out the best in each other. And it's really interesting if you look at the speeches of people when they thank their spouses. You know, in the past, it would be, you know, thank you for all your love and support and care. Oftentimes now people will say, you know, thank you for making me my best self. And it's a real interesting shift. And so there's actually a lot more expectations. We have more expectations from marriage we've ever had. You know, I want you to be my best friend, my partner. I want you to make me my best self. We need to have a super passionate relationship and we need to be stable and raise the kids. It's an incredible amount of pressure we put onto our relationship. And oftentimes these things don't quite sit alongside, right? We want passion and novelty, and we also want comfort and support. You know, these things don't often, sort of sit well in the same sentence.
It's a Superman versus Wonder Woman kind of a match, right?
Exactly. In terms of expectations. And I think, two things are happening, which are really interesting, is that on the one hand, there's nothing wrong with that shift. You know, it is what it is, but it goes alongside a shift towards, and I think this is where the cultural difference comes in, and I'd be interested in your views on India, but certainly in the West, there's a shift to this view of the Disney princess wedding or marriage where, you know, I fight hard to meet Prince Charming and then I live happily ever after. Right? And if I have to work on my relationship, that means the relationship wasn't meant to be. That's a bad sign.
which is very, very damaging for couples. Because I rather think if you are not working on your relationship, if you're not investing in your relationship, then it's a bad thing. Whereas we've come to see such a romantic view of marriage that if we have to invest, it means we picked the wrong person. And this is where we're falling down, because we can't expect our partner to be all these wonderful things, to make us our best selves, to be our best friend, to be passionate, blah, 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 if we're not willing to work on our relationship and invest in it. And so we're seeing this kind of divergence, which I see is very damaging.
And you also talk about the spillover effects of transition one and transition two in the context of how transition three plays out. Talk to us about the insight here.
Yeah, so very often, you know, no couple is perfect. And very often in the throes of transition one and transition two, we will build a path that works, that's okay, but that's not brilliant, right? So one of us may have had to sacrifice more than the other person. We may have found ourselves in a location that just doesn't quite work for us. Or maybe we've ended up in a situation where we're far away from our family and our family's now aging and that's not working for us. And so we start to carry with us baggage from our previous transitions. And so in transition three, couples often have to deal with that baggage. And it might be a career prioritization baggage. It might be that one partner's career was really prioritized, had more importance placed on it. And the other partner feels a bit left behind, and it's time to readjust that balance. It might be a more practical issue in terms of where we live, children, this sort of stuff. But transition three is often complicated because we might have to unpick some of the decisions or some of the dynamics from those earlier two transitions.
And just the other thing I'm curious about, Jennifer, in some of these situations, we make choices where, you know, there's a asymmetry of visibility to long-term and short-term,
yes.
Right? For example, if I think about, you know, in my case, my wife and I, we were having a discussion around, should we have the second child or not?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tendency to look at where we are today and look at the payoffs and possibly make a choice. But again, when we look at that decision a few years down the line, it feels the payoffs are very different. And sometimes you don't see that when you're at the point of making the decision. How have you seen that play out in the context of these transitions and the kind of choices couples make?
Yeah, well, I mean, you and your wife are very conscious of it, which many couples aren't. I think it's difficult because on the one hand, it's really unhelpful if we just focus on the short term. And I see that time and time again in my research. At the same time, it's impossible to predict what life will throw at us. So it's not as if we can stare into a crystal ball and know that, okay, if I decide X, in 5 years' time, it will mean Y. And so it leaves couples in this difficult space, right? Because we're not really sure what will happen in 4 or 5 years' time. But that said, we can have a pretty good guess. And I think couples do well when they have a mindful guess, but they acknowledge that it is a guess. Right. So they think through future scenarios realistically, but they also acknowledge, OK, this may not happen. We cannot bank on this happening. And that's when couples make the best decisions. It's a little bit like in business, the process of forecasting. You know, we don't go through a forecasting process and then expect exactly that to happen. But you would never make a big decision without running some forecasts. And I think we need to adopt that process in our couples and think, okay, we'll never know exactly what happens, but if we can mindfully forecast a few scenarios, at least we're getting into that decision with our eyes wide open. And I think that's the best path for couples.
Talking about forecast, the metaphor that comes to mind is a bit like how tech startups are valued. You know, the P&L is bleeding. You're making losses, but the valuation is running into millions and billions.
Yes.
Because the future valuation is positive. There's hope that future cash flows are positive. So I think,
yes.
How do you look at the balance sheet and not, and of course, the numbers are probability attached, but still, it's sort of that P&L versus balance sheet view, which is interesting.
I think so. And I remember reading a piece of research somewhere, and you'll find this funny, that
that having children doesn't make you happier, but having grandchildren does. Which sort of suggests you do need to have the children first.
That's a long valley of despair to go through.
Exactly. And I thought that pretty much sums it up.
Just as we wrap up this conversation, Jennifer, I'm curious, in your experience, as couples navigate these transitions, do you see them sort of figuring these things out on their own, or do you see that there's a role for a third party, whether it's a sounding board or a coach, to help them make meaningful choices as they go through these transitions?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, couples should never live in isolation. It's always good to sounding board with other couples, with siblings, with parents, with friends, whether that's an external coach, therapist. I think that that can be very helpful. That said, my book is really all around what is the work that couples can do in their couple to help make these decisions and work through those transitions. And so I think it's a balance. There is definitely work we can do in our couple that can really help. We don't default need to turn to a third party, but, you know, we're social animals. Other people have wisdom that we don't. And I always encourage couples to, you know, do the work together, but then, you know, seek other sounding boards, look what other people have done, and seek other opinions, because it can only help.
In my work with leaders, when they use me as a sounding board, I often like to speak to the spouse as a part of my work. It does a few things for me. First things first, it's just super efficient. I tell people that if somebody needs to get to know me, a 15-minute chat with my wife is likely to give them a lot more insight than 10 or 20 one-hour conversations with multiple people around me. I couldn't do that when I was a search consultant earlier, because spouses would be in a sell mode, but in the current work I do, the incentives are aligned and the conversations are extremely productive. Secondly, it gives me a time trend of the leader and how he or she has evolved through the various stints and phases. Thirdly, it also gives me a sense of what energizes and frustrates a leader and what makes the leader come alive. Once we hit midlife and are transitioning to a self-authoring phase of life, borrowing from Bob Keegan, I find that it's as critical to develop a nuanced sense of what energizes the leader, not just inventorize the skills. And this data is often available on the home front. Fourthly, it gives me a nuanced sense of their life context. Understanding the spouse's journey is a key part of the equation when it comes to guiding the leader on his or her choices during transition. And finally, bringing it back to Jennifer Petriglieri's work, I guess our journeys are intertwined, and it makes imminent sense to include the spouse in such conversations so that we get to a meaningful place. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Jennifer. Jennifer, just as we wrap up, you know, are there one or two things that caught you by surprise as you did the research for this book? Given your journey and given the research for the book, what are one or two things that took you most by surprise, if I may ask?
Yeah, so I think the one thing that took me most by surprise is there really is a path to hell for couples. And it's common across all couples across the world at any transition stage. And the path to hell is when a couple develops an imbalance of power. Now, what I mean by power in the context of a couple is a partner has power when they are supported to have a shot at their dreams, whatever those are, professional, personal. It's not about achieving the dreams, right? If I feel supported in having a shot, you know, then the gods decide whether I get them or not. Mm-hmm. And very often what happens in couples is they start with a balance of power, right? We understand each other's dreams. We try to be very supportive of each other. But over time, that power balance tips. And one partner becomes the person who can strive and who can get, and the other partner becomes the person who can't. And across the world, across transitions, when that happens in a couple, it creates a very, very difficult situation. And I think we need to be more mindful about talking about power in our couple and who holds the balance of power.
Jennifer, your work will make a big difference to men and women around the world. I think this piece of work was much needed And it was sort of thank the elephant in the room that never got its due. So thank you for writing this book, and really, really insightful talking to you.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. I hope you found the conversation as purposeful as I did. I do think we end up talking about transitions in individual terms, but we end up living them as couples. So it makes tremendous sense to have language around this. Do consider sharing this with dual career couples that you might be aware of who could benefit with these insights. If you like this conversation, you might also like my conversation with Professor Stuart Friedman of Wharton, who speaks about work-life integration, and my chat with Professor Herminia Ibarra, who speaks about how we evolve our identity as we go about reinventing ourselves. You can go to the guest section at playtopotential.com. You might also like the playlist Maternity Transition, where several women leaders speak about how they and their spouse navigated this transition that's well known to be the key bottleneck in more women bubbling up to the top. You could go to the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com to access this content. Next on the podcast, we have Matthew Walker, author of Why We Sleep.
Many of the impacts of chronic undersleeping, chronic insufficient sleep as we describe it, is that it's an aggravating influence over time. It's very much like hypertension. You know, if you eat the wrong diet or you are not physically active, gradually your blood vessels start to harden and gradually you become more and more hypertensive. Your blood pressure starts to increase. And maybe it's only after 20 years of a lack of physical activity or poor diet that you get hit with cardiovascular disease or a heart attack. And the same can also be true for insufficient sleep. And this is why I think, you know, some people will say, well, I'm in my 60s or in my 70s and I've only been sleeping, you know, 5 hours a night and I'm just fine. And I think there are good examples of this, of, you know, very vocal heads of state, Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan. They were both very clear chest beaters regarding how little sleep that they seemed to need. Now, you mentioned at the start of the program that there are increasing and causal links to insufficient sleep and your risk for Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And tragically, and this is completely not scientific, but I think it's perhaps not coincidental that both Thatcher and Reagan went on to sadly develop the disorder of Alzheimer's disease, and it took their lives.
If you're deriving value from the podcast, please consider paying it forward to Antarang Foundation, an organization I work with closely. Akash Diore and Arman Bansod, the editors of the podcast, are alumni of Antarang Foundation. They do everything from cleaning up the audio, editing it, sequencing it, overlaying it with music, doing the visual elements, and much, much more. Antarang Foundation is a not-for-profit that works with thousands of young adults and helps them play to their potential. While the world of human potential, I believe, is uniformly distributed, the world of opportunity is unfortunately very unevenly distributed. We may not realize it or acknowledge it, but the reality is that a lot of us are beneficiaries of what Warren Buffett calls the ovarian lottery. That sets us up very differently. Sometimes, a simple act of taking a leap of faith and betting on the potential of some of these young adults can add a lot of value to you and transform their lives. To know more, do visit the Pay It Forward section at playtopotential.com. Signing off, this is Deepak Jayaraman. To know more about the advisory work I do, please visit the About the Host section at playtopotential.com. I look forward to having you tune into one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.